Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
Brought to you in part by Maine Operation Game Thief, New Hampshire Wildlife Heritage Foundation, International Wildlife Crime Stoppers, and the North American Game Warden Museum. Hunt of a lifetime, changing lives one adventure at a time, empowering kids with courage. Join us in creating memories for kids facing life-threatening illnesses. We are here to make dreams come true. From magical outdoor escapades to heartwarming experiences, every moment is cherished. With every step of our young heroes, find a network of support, love, families, volunteers, and friends unite to uplift spirits and spread smiles. Amidst breathtaking landscapes, kids find strength they never knew they had. Together, we conquer challenges and celebrate victories. Be a part of the movement that transforms lives. Your contribution can bring courage and hope where it's needed most. Go to huntofalifetime.org to get involved. Let's create a world of cherished moments and unstoppable bravery.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other Game Wardens on our adventures, protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experience of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigation, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.
Warden's Watch, episode 118. Roy Brown, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent, Wyoming. Before I get into this podcast and the description of it, because I wanted to make a few corrections, or at least expand on some of the things you're going to hear during this podcast. So, but I do want to say a shout out to Derek Finnegan. I appreciate Derek is a senior in high school this year in Pennsylvania, and he had to do an interview with his grandfather, is my understanding. And the comment he made to his mother, "I feel like a real Wayne Saunders now," after interviewing his grandfather. Thank you, Derek. That's a very high compliment to be referred to an interviewer. So, and I'm sure you did a great job. that's a pretty cool thing to do, to sit down with your grandfather and interview him. So I'm sure you got some really cool stories out of him. On this episode, I just, as I'm listening through, I talk about a bullfight. So, and when I talk about a bullfight, I'm talking about a moose bullfight. Sometimes, as officers or as game wardens, sometimes I think we take for granted that people know what we're talking about. So I try to clarify a lot of things during the podcast, especially if you have abbreviations for something, and I try to bring that out. So for my listeners that don't know, so that's exactly what I'm doing. So when I refer to a bullfight and a necropsy where the two bull moose were fighting and one actually broke the other one's rib and it stabbed it into the bull's heart. Mike Moody actually did that investigation for us, and the necropsy showed that that's exactly why this bull moose died. So we had a dead bull moose there, and we were trying to find out whether it was poached or not. And it happened to be died of natural causes, where the broken rib actually punctured the animal's heart. So when I talk about the bullfight, it's a bull moose. The other thing I want to talk about is cracker shells, because Roy talks about cracker shells, and game wardens use cracker shells quite often. A lot of people use cracker shells to scare off wildlife. And these cracker shells generally go in a shotgun or shotgun size, but they shoot out of the gun probably 40, 50 yards, and then they explode like an M80. So you usually try to get them in the proximity of the animal to scare it off. A lot of things, if it's coming into your bees, a bear's coming into bees or something like that, and you as a landowner, you probably have it fenced, and then you get this additional thing to scare off the animal. They use them in airports to scare off birds. They use them at dump sites. So when they're piling up refuge and they have a bird problem, they use cracker shells there. Some of them whistle as they go. They whistle, wee, and then they explode. So those are more bird-scaring things. So we definitely try to haze our birds off beaches when it comes to Canada geese and things like that. So cracker shells are widely used to scare off wildlife, and even grizzlies, apparent as Roy talks about, using these cracker shells to scare off grizzlies. Very cool podcast. My first Fish and Wildlife agent, as I say in the podcast, and my first Wyoming game warden. So looking forward to doing a few more. So if you could share the Warden's Watch podcast, I would really appreciate that. I think if you have some friends and you want to share it with them, I'm sure, you know, birds of a feather flock together, and usually generally people that like to listen to the same types of things. So, and if you haven't lately, get on Apple Podcast or somewhere where you can comment, just to let other people know that it's a good podcast. We currently have a 4.9 rating on Apple Podcast, and it's doing very well. We're ranking in the top 100 in the Wilderness Podcast. I think we are up to number 69 in the Wilderness genre, so to speak, or that category. We're in the top 100. We're number 69. So we're climbing the charts too. So, and that's thanks to you guys for sure. It's all about the listeners, and I appreciate all the comments, the input. I've got some really cool back feed lately. Some interviews for, you know, young people wanting to be game wardens and their experiences with their oral boards, things like that. So, hey, thanks for listening. Enjoy. On this Warden's Watch, I'm sitting down with Roy Brown, former U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent. And he started off as a refuge officer, as many special agents around the country do and maybe still do. That's kind of the foot in the door. I know my good friend Bob Snow, and yours too, Roy. That's how we met. He was a refuge officer, and I was a park ranger on Assateague Island National Seashore, which is Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge. It was awesome to hang out with those guys and learn the refuge process, and then give me an opportunity to be a refuge officer in Umatilla. So I got that feeling, and that was Bob's stepping stones. And it sounds like it was your stepping stones as well. So thank you so much, A, You're in Wyoming right now, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And I haven't had a Wyoming game warden on the show yet, so I'm gonna consider you my first Wyoming game warden to start, and then my first U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent. So I hope we break the glass ceiling with this, and we have others to follow. Right?
Yeah. There's several that can give you some really good stories.
Yeah, like we talked about Pat Bosco.
Yeah, he'd be a classic.
He would be a classic, and I. Yeah, he was my U.S. Fish and Wildlife Special Agent to support us in New Hampshire, and he's a very good friend and a great storyteller. And and we all kind of similar type of things. So tell us, let's start off with your refuge and the beginning of U.S. Fish and Wildlife for you.
Actually, I did some seasonal work with the Park Service in Yellowstone at first.
Nice.
Had some a lot of varied experience there, everything from firefighting to road patrol to backcountry work and stuff. And then I had the opportunity to jump over to Fish and Wildlife, which was where my educational background was wildlife more than park-oriented stuff, at the National Bison Range up in Montana, up north of Missoula. It was actually one of the first wildlife refuges Teddy Roosevelt set aside in about 1905. Strictly for the bison, because they wanted to have a backup herd for genetics for the Yellowstone herd. And when I was there, I have no clue whether it's still there, but there was one of the original signs. It was half grown into one of the trees near the boundary. It was kind of cool to see that, the history of how long that place had been there and the purposes it was set aside there. That was kind of the start of it. Worked there, had good bosses there, and
when you think of a refuge, it just, you know, the bison was almost wiped out, and to give them a refuge, a home to stay, to protect, to grow a herd to what we have today. What a huge success story, huh?
It's gone very, very well. You know, even when I was in Yellowstone, the big push was, you know, oh, we got to keep up the high number of bison and stuff, and because they were afraid if they were lax with the management of it, something would happen, and then it'd be very hard to get it back up to the numbers.
Yeah, because we were on the brink of extinction with the bison.
Yeah, especially they were getting so limited spaces where they were.
Right.
So that's where the bison range got kind of its origin, a protected place that they could be. And it actually evolved. They always kept populations of bighorn sheep, mountain goats. They had a few elk, and then they had whitetail and mule deer. And they managed all those different species just besides the bison. You know, the bison, every year, we would gather them up and put them into big holding pens. And the biologists had already figured out, okay, how many do we need to cull and keep the herd viable and mix up genetics and... And they would actually bring in a few from other locales back, because I was there back in the mid-'80s.
Right.
And kind of get it mixed, you know, keep the genes changing up so you didn't get all one.
Right.
And they had one, we'll call a segret cow, who happened to have some of the genes that produced a white bison.
Ooh.
And they were trying to carefully... play with genetics and what they bred her to see if they could get another white bison. They had had one that occurred naturally before they ever said, we need to protect this one cow from, you know, all the other rigors that the others face running around the 20,000 acre refuge.
Right.
So very neat place. It's still there. Now it's run more by the Salish and Kootenai Confederated tribes up there in northwest Montana.
Okay.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife is kind of the trustee now. When I was working there, it was totally run by the service.
Okay.
But when the tribes got up and got their wildlife program going, they wanted to kind of step into that leadership role with the bison.
As they should.
Yes.
You know, it was their animal.
Yep.
So, and when you talk about a white bison, I mean, that was very a spiritual animal to them.
Very
as well.
Much so. Very much so.
Yeah. So, and
we had pictures. I got to see pictures of the one that, I want to say it was in the 40s or 50s, that just by pure luck with genetics, it popped out of one of the cows. And they kind of kept track of that strain where she came from and protected it. It's quite striking in a herd of dark brown, big critters to have this one kind of not pure white, but tannish white almost, mm-hmm. that just stands out immensely. Yeah. That was a fun place to work. That was kind of the start of it.
Yeah.
As we had talked about previously, I got, besides my patrol work on vehicle and horse, also I got to participate in herding the bison from grazing unit to grazing unit, mm-hmm. as well as into the
cowboy stuff.
Yeah, cowboy stuff. It was some interesting rides. I fortunately, they gave me a really solid horse on one of the riding deals we were doing. My horse all of a sudden just stopped, would not move forward. I'm like looking around like, is there a bear? You know, what's around here?
Mm.
And one of the other guys saw me stop, and he was like, hold on a second. Well, there was a little kind of hill or a little rock hill kind of right in front of me that was not very big, but mm-hmm. from my side, I couldn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
He came around from the backside, and there's a rattlesnake coiled up that my horse smelled and would not move a step forward until that snake was dead and gone.
Wow.
It was like, well, I'm glad he's that smart, because I would have kept riding.
That's really, animal's intuition. You know? Watching a bird dog work, same theory, same idea.
There's the bird, and they locked in.
There's something wrong here. I know it. That rattlesnake's here, and I'm not going until I know where it is, and I can get away from it without getting bit.
Yep.
Smart horse. I wish.
Yeah.
If I go riding out there, I want a horse just like that.
It's nice to have a good one that's calm. That's a big key. And not being, they learn to need, the horses need to learn that you're in charge, and
mm-hmm.
then they work with you.
Yeah.
If you're, don't assert a little bit of dominance, they may go off and do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to avoid those horses.
Very smart. And there you went to Tennessee, huh?
Yeah. Bison range job was a kind of a seasonal job. And they wanted me to come back. They said, all right, you know, do what you want for, you know, the winter months.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have you come back in April. And I was talking with the manager, and he said, well, what do you really want to do this winter? I said, I'd like to keep working. You know, I had a truck payment to make.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And so he got working with me, and we checked with a bunch of refuges through his contacts around the southeast who might have wintertime stuff going.
Mm.
And he found a Cross Creeks refuge and a manager by the name of Vicky Graff, who they were doing implementing that winter their first ever on-refuge waterfowl hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And she was looking and wanting someone that could come in and do the law enforcement with the waterfowl hunters, as well as kind of do the day-to-day management of the hunt,
mm-hmm.
so it didn't have to pull staff from other, because they didn't have a big staff.
Mm-hmm.
It was like her and two people and then three maintenance guys, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So having a fresh body in that they didn't have to pull from their limited stock really made it much easier for them. And
mm-hmm.
It was fun. It was got a big introduction for actually born in Massachusetts, going to the South for the first time, changing culture, and learned a lot of new phrases I'd never heard before. And,
oh, my goodness. And they had to, when I went to the South, I went to West Virginia, and they had to put a local boy with me for my protection.
Yeah.
So, and that's not a joke either.
No.
I mean, they, you know, a Yankee down there kind of stood out.
Yep.
So,
yep, they do.
And after a few encounters of mine, they were like, okay, Jimmy's going with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we were a team from them on, and I remember checking fishermen along the New River, and they'd be like, you know, I'd start checking license, and I'd start getting a whole bunch of crap, and all of a sudden Jimmy would come out, and they'd be like, Jimmy, is that you? Yeah, that's me. He's like, what'd you do wrong to get stuck with a Yankee?
Yeah.
And then everything would calm down, and we'd have a good old time. And
one of the first ones that stuck out to me, and you know, I drove a refuge truck.
Mm-hmm.
There were those days, they were tan and had the regular Fish and Wildlife emblem on the door. I got a guy flag me down on heading back into town after work. And I said, pull over. I said, rolled the window down, said, hey, what's up? And he started talking to me. He talked for 10 minutes, and I swear I didn't understand a single word he said. I just looked at him and nodded my head. But this was Dover, Tennessee is really, really rural, small town.
Yeah.
It had the heavy West Tennessee accent that just went right over the Yankee's head as far as what he was saying.
I had a problem with my truck, and I pulled into a filling station, talked to the owner there, and just told him everything that was wrong, and he was just like you, he just didn't say a word. And then at the end, I stopped and I waited, and there was a long pause. He goes, okay, now tell me that all 10 times slower. And I just was like, oh my goodness. So I got back in my truck and I drove to the next one.
It was fun. I had a lot of fun.
It's fun experiencing other cultures. And even within the United States, there's so many little different cultures. You know, I mean, being up on the Great Lakes, Lake Superior, you know, the Swedish influence in there. And it's just, it was it's really cool. And then you go to the South and you experience that Southern. On the Great Lakes, who boils fish?
Yeah.
The churches would have fish boils all the time for fundraisers. And I'm like, maybe they know something I don't, because when you boil a fish, I don't think it tastes very good. So I went to a fish boil once, and it doesn't taste very good.
No, wouldn't think so. And one of the bigger differences, the waterfall culture in the South is so intense, especially in those days in the 80s.
And they have different names for ducks, too, down there.
Yeah,
and you got to learn a whole new language of duck ID.
There was a lot of privately owned clubs or lease clubs that ring the refuge.
Right.
And I woke up one morning and there was about 10 inches of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And for a guy who hunted waterfowl in the northern climes, perfect weather. Let's go slay some ducks. So I said, there's got to be hunters out.
Mm-hmm.
I worked half the day and didn't find a single hunter. Because it never dawned on me that they had no clue how to drive in 10 inches of snow. So they stayed home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everything shuts down in snow in the South for sure. Yeah.
And it doesn't take 10 inches. They do it for a quarter inch.
You're right. It would have been good duck hunting that day,
It was perfect weather for it.
Oh, goodness. So at what point did you make that step from the refuge officer? And I want to clarify, today they're not called refuge officers. They're called just wildlife.
Federal wildlife officers.
Federal wildlife officers uniformed.
Yeah. And a little background on that. I started in 1984. And when I got to the South, we had 12 full-time refuge officers, we were called back then.
Mm-hmm.
And we got kind of we found out we had a nickname from the management people. They called us the Dirty Dozen. Because all of a sudden, you know, they thought everything was hunky-dory on their refuges and this and that.
Mm.
And now they got a full-time officer out there working, and he's ended up doing drugs, DUIs,
right,
all this other stuff that they never even considered.
Mm-hmm.
The stuff that I got involved in, and fortunately I had great relations with like the local city or the county.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized I was a one-man show where they had a whole force. When I transferred from Tennessee, went to North Alabama. The 4 years I was in North Alabama, there were 3 murders that the bodies ended up on the refuge.
Mm.
And they don't teach you that at FLETC.
No.
So I relied on my local guys, and they kind of understood and gladly took over the lead in it. But, you know, that kind of stuff was always different.
Mm-hmm. My first day at Assateague Island National Seashore, I was in plain clothes just starting the paperwork process, the reading all the SOPs and stuff like that. And one of the guys that was working the front desk walks in and calmly says, "Hey, Wayne, somebody just came and said there's a body on the beach." And I'm like, yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
Funny. He's like, "Oh, no, I'm serious. He just came in." So, and I was the only one at the park that day, ununiformed. No. So I grabbed and I sprang into action and quarantined that part of the beach. And I actually pulled him out of the surf too, which was another whole interesting story that I probably shouldn't talk about in this. Maybe another day, because that was that was an experience for a new guy for sure. But didn't want him to, you know, get separated any more than he was. And so anyways, but it's the same thing, you know, and that just reassures that this whole process with this preserving land, managing it, doing all the biology, you need law enforcement, because that's part of the puzzle that makes it work.
You need to manage the public, especially in the areas that are like where you were at Assateague, high public use.
Very high. Piping plovers nesting, absolutely. A lot of interaction, wildlife interaction with people.
Yeah, at Wheeler Refuge in North Alabama, it sat right along the Tennessee River between two big cities, Huntsville and Decatur.
Mm-hmm.
So they all came to recreate on the refuge evenings, especially in the summer, and definitely on weekends. It was a crazy zone.
Absolutely. And crime is sometimes concealed in the wilds, mm-hmm. no matter where you are, and sometimes committed in the wilds because of the privacy of being in remote areas. And who's in remote areas doing police work? You know, there's game wardens, there's sheriffs, there's refuge officers, I got to change my term, but it'll probably never change because
it's deep in the head.
It's ingrained.
that's where in Alabama and a little bit in Tennessee, because of the climate and stuff there was a lot of marijuana growth.
Mm.
Where better place to plant it than on the wildlife refuge where
they can't seize your land.
Yeah, they can't seize your land. And they can't, unless they catch you at it, they can't pin it to you.
Right.
So we did a lot of marijuana eradication, flying in helicopters and on land, and mm-hmm. some of those were hilarious. There was one that because we responded regardless of our agency to whatever they found, mm-hmm. the guys in the helicopter. And we were rolling through downtown Decatur, Alabama, red lights and blue lights going and dealing with traffic and getting play-by-play from the helicopter pilots, mm-hmm. the guys up there, because they had two spotters in the helicopters besides the pilots. They're saying, we got to put down. Mm-hmm. Says, he's coming out of the house. He's going to grab it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they figured before we could get there, this guy would get out there, get it, and dispose of it somehow. Mm-hmm. And they found a place that was darn close. And as they're setting down and hadn't even shut it down, the guys comes running at them, and they're like, what the heck's this? Mm-hmm. Well, he's yelling, it's my dope. You get away. You can't have it. And it was like, well, there's the admission we need, and here's the guy. he wasn't a bright stick in the box.
Oh, man. But that was great. Oh, there's the end of the investigation.
Yep.
Oh, man.
I wish they all did that. That'd make it so easy.
Oh, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? For sure. For sure.
And the other funny part of working that is, you know, the local cities kicked in people as well, officers.
Nice.
And when we got to the more rural areas, they were with us. Mm-hmm. And we were going through trails to get to this one hidden, semi-hidden patch. It was on private property. But they would try to hide it so you couldn't see it. And there was this big officer ahead of me on going down the trail. You know, he was all pumped up until he went to take a step, and that stick that was across the trail slithered off into, and this, I'm not kidding, this guy was like 6'5 or so and 250-60 pounds, and he screamed like a little girl and jumped up and down. And I just laughed, and he just kind of scowled at me. I said, you city boys.
Yeah, I don't know, I've always had that reaction with snakes too. They're not my favorite thing, but I worked with Matt Holmes up in New Hampshire, and one day I heard him do the same thing, scream like a little girl. And it was funny because the grass we were in was pretty high. I mean, it was, you know, like just below your waist belt, between your knees and your, and I could see his knees popping up as he was kind of running through the grass. So, yeah, Matt's not a big fan of snakes.
No.
And it's more the surprise for me than the snake itself. It's just that shocker when you, there it is, and now what kind is it? And
what I look for is which way was it going?
Right.
If it was going away from me, I didn't care.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of experiences in West Virginia were on a mountain bike as I'm flying down through the trails. And, you know, I don't even know how many snakes I saw as I passed.
Yeah.
Or, you know, one time I rode right over the middle of one unintentional, just flying down through, and he was in the middle of the trail, and off I went. And, you know, but, that's one nice thing about living in the North. That's we don't have to worry about with poisonous snakes.
Too much,
too
Wyoming,
much.
All we got is the rattlesnake.
Yeah.
And they're, compared to what I was used to in the South, our rattlesnakes were maybe a 2-inch diameter max and 2 foot long out there. Of course, some ones I saw in the Southeast, we had timber rattlers and whatnot that were like 6 foot long. And
jeez.
About 8 or 10 inches around. It's like some big boys, big difference.
Yeah, that's a little unnerving to think about that. So
But that was the last refuge I worked at. And the whole time I started working with refuges, Montana, Tennessee, and Alabama, I always would work with the local agent on various things.
Nice.
At the bison range, we had guys that would slip in and stockpile antlers, and then in the middle of the night, and then they come back like a week later in the middle of the night and get that stash and take it off, because they're worth, those days, at least $10 a pound or so.
Wow.
Then, you know, what better place to go look than on a wildlife refuge where the critters are
incredible. Yeah, I think of some of the racks that I saw in Chincoteague, I believe now has a season, but we used to go up through some of the refuge areas to see some of these bucks, and, you know, 10-pointers were common.
Yeah.
Common. That was the standard deer you were going to see on the refuge, and you'd get up just to these crazy antlered deer.
Yeah.
And, you know, 18 points, 20, and it would sit there and
no
count
hot pressure
on them. Live and get fat and... Yeah, so when you talk about antlers dropping on a refuge, you're talking about some huge antlers dropping on a refuge.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, that kind of stuff, plus waterfowl up there. And then when I got to the south with the both states, I worked a lot with the agents with dove hunting and waterfowl hunting.
Yep.
And that kind of was getting the foot in the door, getting known.
Mm-hmm.
I had kept applying. I think I applied 4 times before I finally got picked up because it's so competitive.
Yeah.
And they told us when my class was hired that we only hired 10 new agents, and there were 5,000 applicants for those 10 jobs.
Jeez.
And they had to weed through all those, and, you know, some were easy to weed through. You know, and others were like, okay. They
when
really
you start with 5,000 and you even cut 4,000 out, you still have 1,000 for 10 applicants. Yeah.
So,
10 positions. Yeah. That's crazy.
And it had a great bunch that came on with, I think all of us are retired. I think all of us are retired now. There might be one still working.
Yeah.
She was fresh out of college, and she's from New Jersey, and she wanted to stay in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And New Jersey isn't the most popular state for agents back then, especially. So they scooped her up because she was a... merit scholar, did very high GPA and stuff.
Yeah.
Very sharp gal.
Yeah.
So she may still be working because she was a good, I think, 10 years younger than me.
Okay.
And that would put her at mid-50s right now. So she's getting close, but not quite there. Anyway, first duty station they sent me to was Salt Lake City. Worked a lot of waterfowl here because of the Great Salt Lake, and actually hit down here at Utah Lake, but got into some various different cases. I worked southern Utah a lot with the wardens down there, and they had a problem with herp collectors, snake collectors, and Gila monsters. So I'd go down and work with them, and we tried to, because they knew the country, we'd find a good spot where they knew the snakes would be out on the pavement on these remote roads, and we'd sit up and where they couldn't be seen, but we could see. And try to catch the guys coming in, driving the road slow, and they'd see a Western King Snake or a Gila, and, you know, then they would stop and they'd get out and they have their bag and tools and put them in the bag and sell them for the sale. They would sell them for the trade.
Right.
Also got into that, leads into a little bit later. I got a call from an informant and said, "Hey, I just had a young guy try to sell me a bunch of venomous snakes." I said, "Really, really?" He said, "Okay." So he gave me his name and stuff, and I started doing background on him and checking. He had just moved back to Salt Lake from, I think it was Colorado maybe, or somewhere else that he came from. Well, he didn't realize that to have any of those types of snakes in Utah, you had to have special permits. So I tried to make contact and see about buying them, and he was a little cautious there, but I pulled together enough info to do a search warrant on his house. This guy had Egyptian cobras, had rhino vipers, Gaboon vipers, a couple, three different rattlesnake species, and copperheads. And I was like, yeah. And he had them in a little room about the size of the room we're in right now, which is what, 10 by 12 or so?
Yeah, that's exactly what I give it, 10 by 12.
And he had them in these little holding pens that his little kids could walk in there and undo the latch on. They weren't secured. And I was like, holy smokes.
Gives you a little pucker factor, doesn't it?
Yeah, I could just picture those poor, little kid, see his dad handling them.
Yeah.
And then Mm-hmm. He goes in when Dad's not there and opens one up.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had my partner at the time was not a snake fan.
Yeah.
But he had to come with because he was my partner.
I would have been with him. I understand.
Yeah. So once we got the preliminary stuff done with the guy, you know, got statements from him and, you know, told him that we were going to have to seize the snakes.
Mm-hmm.
My partner all of a sudden says, I got to go outside. And he disappeared outside. He didn't want to be anywhere around when we started pulling the snakes out of containers.
Yeah.
But the funny part of that is he went outside and just stayed away because of his phobia, but he stumbled across a shipping crate that had come from an outfit called Crutchfields in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a shipment that had just recently arrived.
Hmm.
So now we got evidence of him importing illegally from Florida into Utah, cross country.
Yeah.
And actually ended up, we also prosecuted the guy in Florida.
Nice.
And he was well known to our agents in Florida.
Uh huh.
And he tried to get us to put our case with the Florida agent's case. And
yeah.
My AUSA said, nope.
Huh.
Says, you violated Utah law, you're going to face charges here in Utah.
Yeah.
And he got dinged pretty good. And, of course, my fortunate thing for me is during my time in Salt Lake, I'd met the guy who worked at the VA hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole job at the VA is he milked snakes to make anti-venom.
Oh, wow.
So I got a hold of him, told him what was going on. We're going to do the search warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, would you be willing to come with us and positively identify, because snake expert,
mm-hmm.
And then you handle and you hold all the snakes.
Because
mm-hmm. He had facilities. Right. I had an office.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, one condition, as long as I can milk the rare ones in, you know, for his anti-venom
yeah.
stuff. I said, it works for me. It's mm-hmm. That's an even trade.
Yeah.
And yeah. We had set up after that they went to the local zoo
yeah.
after he was done.
But that's something that has to be done that people don't think yeah. about. That's where the anti-venom comes, is from yep. the venom. So somewhere out there, there's snakes being milked so we can get our hospitals filled with these anti-venoms in case yeah. there is a bite yeah. that they can do that and give that. Yeah.
And,
so.
And he was really tickled about having the exotic stuff.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because that's stuff that he probably wouldn't have a source to milk mm-hmm. and get anti-venom for. Mm-hmm. And there's enough, you know, snake collectors out there that
right.
it's a distinct possibility.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. So nowadays, I mean, somebody could have anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was probably my favorite in Utah. And, you know, because there was a lot of other stuff, a lot of import-export,
because mm-hmm.
There was a lot of direct flights into the Salt Lake Airport from yeah. all over the Pacific, especially in Mexico. And I had a ton of mariachi band frogs from Mexico that I had to keep in my office and tagged until the deal was done.
Oh, man.
It was like tourists see them, kids want them, and they mom and dad buy them, stuffed iguanas or another.
Yeah.
It's like, all right. And then those we just disposed of, destroyed, and just, I'm sure there was no permits.
Mm-hmm.
When they bought them in Mexico, and they actually should have had permits from the Mexican government.
Right.
To even buy them and then bring them out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yep, those souvenirs that nobody thinks of. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a biologist that worked for the service. She and her husband went to Africa. And that was a meeting that they were there and a whole bunch of people were there. And, you know, got visiting with everybody in breaks and stuff and mm-hmm. noticed that she had elephant hair bracelet on.
Really?
And the agents, we start looking at each other that saw it, and we're like, ooh, that's not good. That's not legal to bring into the U.S.
Yeah.
And so we let the upper echelon handle that one because she was mm-hmm. higher up on the biologist mm-hmm. ranks. And,
yep.
And we told him what it was, and he said, okay. So he had a chat with her and told her. She was like, oh. She didn't realize.
No.
So, yeah, you never know what you're going to run into.
Mm-hmm.
Utah, great time, great guys to work with over here. Still a lot of them, most of them now are like me, retired.
Yep.
And then from there, Lander, Wyoming duty station opened up.
Yeah.
And Jim Klett, who had been there, had been there for 12 years, and everybody figured he was going to die there, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until it was mandatory, he was there.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a family situation come up that they needed to be closer to their parents and stuff. And
right.
Had the opportunity to transfer back close to home. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know how many put in, but I said, I've got to try for it. I told my wife, I said, that's one of my dream locations.
Mm-hmm.
For me, if I'm not going to be on the actual coastline, I want to be in the Rockies, in the mountains.
Right.
And no, Utah was close.
Mm-hmm.
But not because of my Yellowstone experience.
Right.
So I threw my name in the hat, and lo and behold, I was selected for it. So wife always jokes with me or with people now, says, yeah, she said, she's going to see the whole U.S., marry him, move here, move there. Said, went to Salt Lake, got to see that, went to Lander, never left. So now I'm trying to make that up to her with the traveling, now that we're both retired, and get her to see places she never got to see.
I'm doing the same because our jobs require a lot of us and take a lot away from our families during that time frame. So, yeah, when you retire, you try to make that up to them.
yeah, especially when they stuck with you through it all.
Yeah.
I tell people, I says, I took an Alabama girl, brought her to the Rocky Mountains, and she's never seen more than an inch or two of snow in her whole life. And while we're in Salt Lake, I was down south Utah, which is a lot warmer than Salt Lake City area, working, and the first snowstorm came. When I got home, she had shoveled the driveway. She had driven into work, never driven in that kind of snow before.
Yeah.
The snow in our backyard was level with the top of our picnic table.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I threw her in the briar patch.
I guess you did. That's a lot of shoveling and a lot of training. So
she got used to it. That helped break her in, so she doesn't worry about it now.
Yeah, for sure. And while you're in Wyoming, you're doing other things, too. You're going, let's face it, the feds like to see you travel.
Yeah.
They ship you here, they ship you there when they need an agent, and sometimes you're going everywhere. Yeah, so I've it's not like...
gone all over the country, basically, for work details, takedowns, we're doing arrest warrants, or one of the fun ones, a team out of the Southwestern region, was a paddlefish case where they were being illegally taken and whatnot. And one of our agents had worked his way in with them. And it turns out they were shipping them from Oklahoma, I think was the main area, maybe Missouri a little, by semi truck, all the way to Seattle to send them over to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a phone call from the agent doing the case, and he's an old friend of mine. He's a former refuge guy as well. And he says, hey, we're going to do a rolling surveillance on this semi-truck. And when we get to Wyoming, we want you to jump in and take the eyeball, basically.
Right.
And
so he doesn't get curious that same vehicle has been following him.
Always seeing different vehicles.
Yeah.
And says, you got it. You need it. And I had a guy out of Casper, and the newer agent, and he was in his truck, and I was in my truck, and we kept swapping the eyeball, and we're going through southeastern Wyoming. Everything was fine, you know. And we get up to kind of my country and a little west of me over towards Kemmerer and stuff, and, you know, the rest of the guys were still following us, but back.
Mm-hmm.
And we were keeping in touch by radio, and when we get up towards Kemmerer, there's snow on the road. All these boys from Texas, they all automatically start going 40 miles an hour. And we're still doing highway speeds, following this truck, doing highway speeds. And they were like, how can you do that? That just totally caught them off guard.
Mm-hmm.
That here we have snow in the springtime in Wyoming. And you know, we've pretty much, since we've lived there 28 years, we've seen it snow every month of the year.
Yeah.
You just never know.
That's the truth.
But that was fun, you know. Because we went all the way into Oregon, and then we handed our roll off to the agents from that area, and that was fun. It just cracked me up to think about those Texas guys, agents hitting the snow because they'd never see it.
That went down slow. Yeah.
And then, of course, in Wyoming, a lot of the stuff was grizzly bears and wolves because I was there in 95. And that's when the wolves were released in Yellowstone. And
yeah,
that was a big focus.
Controversy there.
Big controversy. A lot of interesting meetings with ranchers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even some big public meetings and whatnot. And I got a call from a guy. Actually, he went through the Game and Fish hotline. He says, I trapped me a wolf, and I come get your damn wolf. So they called me, and it was early enough in the deal. I got a hold of the local game warden. You know, where exactly is this ranch? Because all I had was a name.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the middle of winter. So he says, all right, meet me here, and I'll go in with you. And we had another guy that was going to come join us with a bear trap, because we don't know really what we got yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we get there, and this guy tells us his version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he claims that he saw this wolf and his sheep, and he ran it down and lassoed it with a rope off his snow machine.
Really?
Oh, that's a pretty good trick.
You know? Yeah, it's a pretty good lassoer, driving a snow machine and lassoing.
Because
the horse kind of runs itself while you're lassoing, but the snow machine, I don't see that happening.
You got to keep pressed.
Yeah.
Not quite feasible.
Mm.
And then he actually had it in the horse trailer. And you know, we're looking at it and saying, oh, it could be a wolf. But something ain't right. So we were like, all right, you know, we'll get it out of there. So we worked it and we sedated it and put it in that bear covert trap. And we got looking at it while we had it sedated. And the state guy and I look at each other and just smile. We could tell by looking at it that what he did is he ran it over with his snow machine. Because all the marks, and we brought it up to him just to see after, you know, we kind of, okay, we know what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, it tried to get out through the slats in the top of the horse trailer. And I'm going, okay, let me see. How's a wolf get up that high in a horse trailer that's, you know, like almost 10 feet tall and get its leg through that opening and end up with that kind of injury? Not feasible. But
no.
He stuck to his story, and I brought it home. I had it in that trailer for a day or so in my driveway. But fortunately, Wyoming's rural enough where we were. Mm-hmm. No one else saw it.
Right.
The more I go out and look at it, and I said, let me see. So I took a little stick and stuck it in through the back of the grate, and it snapped at it and grabbed onto it and kind of shook its head. I don't think that's really wolf-like to my training.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that's not adding up here, and it doesn't quite look right because there's a difference in head shape and whatnot. And finally got it sent up via airplane, sedated again, and via airplane sent it up to Yellowstone, and they put it in their holding pen to watch it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And after watching it for a while, and then they went and did measurements and did some blood tests, it was a hybrid that someone had turned loose.
Mm.
And, you know, of course, none of the anti-wolf people would want to believe that.
Right.
But we ran into that a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other funny one on wolves was the...
I've run into hybrids quite often in the East because a lot of people like to have them. Yeah, and
so they're not legal in Wyoming.
Yeah, and when they're a hybrid, they're a domestic animal. They're not a wolf, so the Department of Agriculture is actually responsible for wolf hybrids.
Right.
So, which was good in some ways.
Yeah.
It would have been nice just not to have them.
Yeah. The wolves were funny. Difference, it's not negative against them. They're trained different. Their background's different. But I worked a lot with the guys in Teton National Park.
Mm-hmm. And
we would have dead wolf show up.
Yeah.
And because the collar would go off. And the wolf biologist for Wyoming was in Lander office just down the road from me.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get these calls, let's go. And they would tell, swearing to death, you know, on the phone and on the radio, yeah, it was shot. And Mike and I get there, and we're looking at it, and there's no exit wound. What kind of rifle can you shoot a wolf with that's not going to go all the way through that skinny body? They're not that heavily muscled.
Mm-hmm.
They're muscular, but they're not like a grizz.
Right.
So we're going, this thing right. So we keep looking, and what we were able to find out, because I used the Wyoming lab a lot because it was easier to get critters to rather than shipping to Ashland, Oregon.
Yeah.
And they agreed with us, and they looked deeper and determined it was went after a bull elk and got gored and died from that wound and was never shot to begin with.
Okay.
So it was okay. Nature taking its course.
Absolutely, yeah.
So
that's the interesting part is to find that. We did a necropsy on two bulls one time that were had been fighting, and you know, one bull was dead, and so during that portion, we gutted it and looked at it. One of the ribs had broken during a fight with another bull and pierced his heart.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was his day.
Yeah.
And kind of crazy. Yeah. But, until you open them up and kind of dissect that and figure out that cause of death, I mean, and it's sometimes nature.
Yep. Yeah. We had just briefly, we had another one turn up dead and just, it was middle of winter again, so it's not grizzly bears involved
because they should be sleeping.
and we had to send to the lab because what the heck killed this thing? Well, it got in a fight with a mountain lion is what the lab determined, and the mountain lion somehow got its jaws over the top of the wolf's head and the skull and punctured and crushed it a little.
Unbelievable.
From a field necropsy looking at it, that's going to be really hard to detect.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to basically dissect the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And we did that with grizzly bears, but we didn't use it to do it with the wolves.
Right.
The state guys and I, Mark Persino initially and Brian DeBolt later, we did a ton of field necropsies on grizzly bears.
Mm-hmm.
And because we needed to determine what we could. We needed to see if the story matched up with what the shooter said. Believe it or not, probably 80%+ of them, they
matched
did
up.
It in self-defense.
Yeah.
We had the classic sometimes. We had a guy shoot a grizz, and then I don't remember what the distance was. And yeah, he swore it was self-defense and whatnot, and got to examining it, and we found a bullet hole. But then there was this another bullet hole up in the neck, but it had a wadding in it from a shotgun shell. Going, that wad, you'd have to be right on top
pretty
of
dang
it
close.
For that to penetrate.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it flies off somewhere.
That's right.
And we're like, nah, not tell us the real story.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he finally came clean that he shot it and then panicked.
Uh-huh.
Didn't think he wanted to make it, in his mind, make it look more like a self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And he screwed it up totally. I had one wolf case that was funny to me. This guy was hunting solo. He was from, he was from Utah. And he was over near Pinedale.
Mm-hmm.
And he had camped out, and his horses were excited one morning. You could see him looking at something, so he went and looked, and it was literally about 250 yards away or so. There's this wolf just walking broadside, paying him no attention. Well, he gets the wild idea he's going to shoot it and take it home, and he does. And then when he goes to leave, he runs into a Wyoming Game Fish Hunter check station. Now he's got to come up with a story.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells the folks at the check station that he shot it in self-defense, that it was coming at him and his horses, and they were getting all panicked, and so he got down on a log and shot it. Well, when we did the necropsy, the angle of the bullet, were you in Tony Lathram's presentation? Tony and I did, he did the forensics with the firearm stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He and I did a lot of the same type of work.
Yeah.
And the angle, it was a quartering away shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one rifle shot all the way through. And when he took us back to the place, we could find no evidence at a reasonable distance. So I kept him talking, and I forget which state guy it was, because we usually had a warden as well with us.
And mm-hmm.
He kind of started doing a search out in that area.
Yeah,
and he got about 250 yards away, and there's fur and other signs of this is where something was shot.
Mm-hmm.
So we collected that, and of course they can match the fur,
right,
and all that stuff. And he was going to fight it at first, And he told me at court, says, yeah, I was going to fight it. And then he had called and asked what the fines were. And I gave him a ballpark of what they typically could be. And I gave him the max, of course. And
yep.
He said, no. He says, I actually did just shoot the thing. And I could waste twice as much money on a lawyer or just take my medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided that when it came down to it, he was just going to take his medicine.
Yep.
Rather than waste all that money and try to fight it.
Yep. And that's usually the smart thing to do. You know, it's been my experience because working, you know, being able to prosecute your own cases, you treat people as they treat you. You want to plea, and I'll treat you the best I can.
I've used that several times.
Yeah.
A couple of interesting things. We did a grizzly bear. A couple of hunters out of Casper, Wyoming, were up in what's called Pacific Creek area, over in kind of just south of Yellowstone, National Forest lands. And they had were going up elk hunting on foot, and they came back and called it in and notified everybody. That's how we found out. So we went up in, and they were going up the trail, and all of a sudden they see a sow grizz kind of wolfing at them and stuff, and then she kind of disappears, and they're like, what do we do? Because they were thinking if we run, she's going to run us down.
Right.
Because she can run way faster than they can.
Mm-hmm.
And what turned out to be is she had two yearling cubs that were almost as big as Mama.
Yeah.
And she was protecting them. So she charged them, and they shot it at 10, 15 yards.
Wow.
And so we actually took it because it was right on a heavily used trail. We couldn't leave the carcass there because that brings in other bears and whatnot. And so we got a helicopter. And
I was going to say, that's a job to remove a grizzly's carcass.
Yeah, and fortunately, there's under the Wilderness Act, there's a stipulation for law enforcement purposes to use that kind of stuff when needed. We didn't abuse it. We did it on those types of situations that public safety was a concern.
100%.
But anyway, that got real interesting because we got there, and when we flew in, the helicopter pilot flew over the sow carcass, and the two yearlings were trying to nurse her.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he buzzed them, and they scattered, and about a quarter mile away, he put us down another open meadow, and he told us later on his way back out to wait for us further down. He buzzed them again, and they were still trying to nurse Mama.
Mm-hmm.
So what made that really interesting, everything was fine for like the first 15 minutes. You know, we're getting there because we do a crime scene just like you would a murder. And all that worked out and done and documented. And all of a sudden, here come two yearling cubs. And one of the guys, Tim Fox, he was on that side. So he's, you know, spooked them off. And we get back to work, and a little while later, heard they come around this side on my head. So I spook them off, and we go like, all right. I stood over on this end where they had just come from, and Tim went on the other end. We had shotguns with us. With cracker shells was the first one. Slugs were next.
Yep.
And we let Fred and Brian finish up what we need to do still on the crime scene. Fred was the state investigator out of Jackson. And sure enough, them dang things, Tim and I played ping pong with them. They kept coming to him, and then they come back around to me, and they came a different path on one of those times. They were literally 20 yards from me before they came out of the timber where I could see them. So I whipped up the shotgun, and they were close enough when I shot the cracker shell. It actually hit the bear on the shoulder first before it bounced right off and exploded kind of next to his head. Because those are timed to go off at a certain distance.
Right.
And they were closer than that distance. So that was close to being a little more of an emergency than I would have been comfortable with.
Yeah.
Because a yearling grizz is about as big as Mama.
Yeah.
They're not tiny little things. So.
No.
So, yeah, that get
certainly right, able to survive on their own.
Up, yeah. Because she would have kicked them out before she hibernated that winter.
They right.
Been on their own.
Yep. Yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that we ran into, comical, just brief. I'll give you some of the comical ones that they're funny after the fact. Even the guys involved laughed. They're the ones that actually brought it up to us. Family was up hunting way up in the mountains. And one guy still hadn't filled his tag, and him and one of the other guys went, but the hunt guy who already filled his tag did not bring a gun with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just there, okay, I'll scout, and we'll find you an elk. And they were glassing a herd of elk, and there was a creek right there. So he was kind of squatted in that creek, looking this direction. And the other guy is kind of over against the bank looking at the elk so he could rest if they found one he wanted to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing the guy squatted in the creek knows is a sow grizzly with a cub had spotted him and came up behind him, and he never heard her because of the water running, and bit him in the butt.
Oh.
And of course, that started the rodeo.
Oh.
He ended up much better off than he could have. But it was a big rodeo, and afterwards nothing was funny when it was going on.
Yeah.
He says, but when I got home and my wife took my jeans and he had a handkerchief, the old style handkerchief,
yeah,
the patterns and stuff,
yeah,
in his back pocket. When she went to fold it, she shook it out, and there were canine puncture holes in every corner of that where it folded when the bear bit him in the rump. So he kept it as a souvenir. He was telling us he was going to frame it.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, because he made out okay in the big picture.
Mm.
You got to be aware up there, right, of everything.
And
he said, I should have had my rifle with me, even though I wasn't hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't need it. And in my mind, I said, all right.
Right.
But it's a different world. You're in their world up there.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
We're no longer especially if we don't have firearms, we're no longer the apex predator.
Right.
And basically, I did 20 years worth of grizzly investigation. So there's all kinds of them. We had one we called the gummy bear. Got a call from an outfitter. He had clients, I want to say, from New Hampshire, if I remember right.
Yeah.
An older couple. He had the tag, and she came along just for the fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was a horseback trip. And he got him a nice little bull elk. And they did their stuff, and they sent the assistant guide back to camp to get the pack critters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the old-timer guide, he lays back and starts taking a nap. And husband and wife, for some reason, they had read somewhere that if you take pine boughs and wave them like fans, it keeps all the bugs away from the carcass and the meat and stuff. So they're there fanning this carcass, and up over the ridge next to them, all of a sudden comes a grizzly bear.
Mm.
And they run, and they literally played. You could see it in the duff on the dirt where they played Ring Around the Rosie around the tree with it.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, the guide's kind of waking up, like, what's going on? And so he shoots it, which, totally legit, because we're talking, they were all within a 15-foot radius of each other.
Yeah.
But when we got there and looked at the bear, the guide says, look at this. And we open its mouth. All of its teeth were down to gum line. Mm. He was so old, they had worn his teeth down so far, he probably could not have killed a live critter himself. Because there was no canines to do the damage.
Mm.
But he was after that gut pile that had the soft, chewy stuff that he could still eat.
Right.
But yeah, that was a unique one. I've never seen one that old, that worn down.
Right. And hence the use of silencers on weapons when you're hunting in grizzly country and things like that. So they don't know, they don't hear it as well.
Because
it's a dinner bell, right?
Well, to an extent, but their smell is the main factor.
Is it? Okay.
They can smell stuff a mile away.
Yeah. I got a buddy in Alaska that deer hunts, and they pack out most of their meat on mountainsides and stuff. And he's like, that's the first thing.
Yeah.
As you always got to be aware of what's going on. Pick your head up, look around, be efficient, be quick.
Yep, you've got to.
Because those brown bears sneak right up on you, and he's like, it's unnerving.
They smell it. And
he's like, let them have it.
Yep. Yeah, so they,
They're
smelling. They hear well, but their eyesight's not the greatest.
Uh-huh.
And, I've had so many folks unfamiliar with grizzly bears tell me, oh, it was going to attack me. It was up on its hind legs. That's not true. When they get up on their hind legs because they're curious, they're trying to see what you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're moving their head like, yeah, what is that over there?
Right.
So, yeah, I get all those reports, but you know, so many of them are legit self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
I had an old-timer. I mean, this guy was in his 70s, still solo hunting for elk and stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, not he wouldn't go way back in the backcountry anymore just because, and I can relate to that at my age now, my knees wouldn't handle it.
Right.
But he had the camper on his on the back of his pickup, and he took off one morning, and he always brought his dog with him, which for me was big game hunting, and dogs, they could smell it.
Right.
It makes sense. But anyway, mm-hmm. it was his, I think he was more concerned about predators, mm-hmm. and the dog would probably sense predators before he ever would.
Good point, you know.
But he had stopped because he had climbed a hill coming out of his campsite and stopped to catch his breath, and he looked back. And here's this grizz basically following the exact same trail that he and the dog had just taken.
Mm.
He was like, uh-oh. So he kind of stayed there because he had timber right there. And it came, you know, it didn't, I'll say it went straight to him, but following his trail.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually let that thing get 25 yards before he shot it.
Mm.
And it was still coming straight towards him. And I'm like, you know, and I tell him, I says, as long as the distance is reasonable for your personal comfort,
mm-hmm.
the guy with the wolf at 250 yards,
not so much.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, 35 feet, 35 yards, you know, it all mm-hmm. is a matter of how comfortable you are.
Yeah.
You know, my incident with the yearlings, you know, mm-hmm. I could hold back and not do that second round until I knew what that firecracker had.
Mm-hmm.
And
I imagine that was very effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it you could see it when it blew almost next to his head. He was like, mm-hmm. whoop.
Yeah.
And turned around and ran off, and the second one just followed him.
Right.
Because she heard it, but it wasn't right next to her.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a difference, and that's one of the things with Wyoming. Great place to hunt, but for non-residents, it's a very hard place to draw.
Mm.
And they do it for one of the reasons is in wilderness, non-residents have to have a guide, mm-hmm. a licensed outfittering guide. They've done too many search and rescues.
Mm-hmm.
Understandable.
Yeah, and people.
It's expensive.
You know, yes, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, you know, guys who are a good horseman back home, mm-hmm. but they don't ride those mountain trails
right.
that, like we have out there.
Yeah.
And they get in wrecks, and you got to come in with a helicopter. But if you know, the guides are trained, the outfitters are trained,
mm-hmm.
they have it all, everything kind of already in protocol where they need to call based upon where they're at.
Yeah.
And get the crew in to rescue them and stuff.
Yeah.
Even, you know, some of my friends there in Lander, you know, I rode horses as part of my work.
Mm-hmm.
The government provided me, initially I had two horses, at the end I had one. To do that kind of backcountry work.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had friends that have ridden for years. As I tell people, I says, if you ride horses long enough, you're going to have an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had friends had break their backs, break their legs.
Mm-hmm.
And even though very experienced riders rode for decades,
mm-hmm.
it's going to happen eventually.
You know?
It's a matter of luck. You know?
Mm.
So, yeah, there's... It's rough enough wilderness and country, and some of the New Hampshire country is pretty nasty, too, in the higher up for elevations there. I speak from experience from my younger days.
Yeah, for sure.
But, yeah, it's you got to be a lot more aware and a lot more geared towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And briefly, if we got a couple more minutes, I'll touch on some of the other stuff we got to do as agents. And I was one of our instructors for firearms, and I was also mm-hmm. an armorer.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of teaching for other agencies,
mm-hmm.
Everything from local police departments all the way up to U.S. Marshals and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I had a lot of teaching experience, and one of the guys that was running the training program, they started doing international training, and particularly in the continent of Africa. And so I had the unfortunate duty of five times going over to Africa and teaching game wardens from different countries over there, how to do crime scene investigations.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, anybody could teach it, any good agent, warden for sure.
Yeah.
But the extra kicker is having done the grizzly and the wolves, dealt with big, dangerous critters.
Exactly.
Like they have.
100%, yeah.
And they, you know, they could, I could flash pictures up there of dead grizzly bears, and they're like, ooh, that's a big boy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got a 500-600 pound, some of the biggest were up around 800 pound.
Right. Comparable to, yeah, you know, a lion, mm-hmm, a rhinoceros, a, yeah, hippo.
And then when you show them, you know, you know, because there's some pictures we're looking at their teeth. We got pictures of it.
Yeah.
And see how big those canines are. And
yeah.
So it's that was a lot of fun. That it was really neat to go over there and teach them to see the light bulbs go off in their head.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, because they had a lot of trouble in a lot of those countries where they were never taught how to collect evidence and preserve it.
Mm.
And so it got to court. And sometimes the evidence couldn't be found.
Because
a couple of the guys told me in their country, any evidence they had to turn over to a local police department. And depending upon how ethical that guy was, it may disappear, it may not.
Mm-hmm.
It may still be there.
And everything for a price.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they, you know, there's a lot of stuff they'd never thought about. And grand, mm-hmm, they wouldn't, why would you,
yeah,
of how to do things and tricks, mm-hmm, and stuff that we've learned,
yeah,
got to share with them. That was, mm-hmm, rewarding and a very good part of the whole agent experience. And,
mm-hmm,
but yeah, and that's, you do so many different things in a wildlife career, like, you know,
mm-hmm,
you know, when I worked in the Park Service, they trained me in mountain rescue and firefighting.
Yeah.
When I went to the Southeast, I was on a team where we climbed into bald eagle nest and banded eaglets with wing markers and leg bands.
Awesome.
Yeah, the lowest nest was like 30 feet, and the highest was 110 feet in the air.
Yeah, so cool.
So, yeah, and you're literally climbing into some of the nests were half the size of this room.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the size of a pickup truck bed is very common on a bald eagle nest.
Yeah.
Just some... In the wildlife business, a lot of really cool stuff that
you
can get into. Just, you never know. It's different parts of the country, different things.
Exactly. That's why I love talking about things that I don't know, like grizzlies and all those things that, yeah, I didn't get to experience in the East. It fascinates, yeah, me. So,
yeah. Did you ever know Bobby Garabedian? He was our agent in Albany for years.
I knew of him.
Okay. When I went through the special agent basic training after the got hired as an agent, and they do it for everybody. They set up a kind of a check station at a port,
mm-hmm,
you know, where you drive into the country.
Yep.
And I'd been out west for several years and dealt, mm-hmm, with grizzly bears, you know, prior to going to the Southeast. And in the trunk of the car that pulls up is a grizzly bear hide. And I'd look at it, and he just knows it's a bear hide.
Mm-hmm.
And I start pointing out all the difference why I can say it's a grizzly bear, of course, in threatened species,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, why it's more protected than the black bear would be and whatnot. And he was like, I never knew any of that.
Mm.
But he was New York.
Right.
He didn't deal with grizzly bears.
Right.
When I first, that first stint in Yellowstone as the internship, that we had a call from an elderly lady in Gardner, Montana, just outside the north entrance.
Mm-hmm.
And she had I don't know, half a dozen choke cherry trees, crab apple trees in her yard, both. And the bears, a sow with a cub was coming in every night, every evening, and would sit there and gorge on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she couldn't go anywhere out of her house.
So she was locked out.
Yeah. She was locked in the house. And, you know, she called, you know, can you help me?
Mm-hmm.
So they went and set up traps.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they finally trapped both mama and the bear in two separate traps.
Mm.
And so they grabbed a hold of me because I was working in the chief ranger's office during the internship.
Yeah.
And they brought it right there to Mammoth. And they said, all right, Roy. She sedated and pulled her out of the trap and said, all right, you hold her head. Here's this guy,
mm,
with a semester to go in college still, never seen a grizzly bear in his life yet. I've got a sow grizzly head in my hands. It's the size of a basketball with canines about 2 inches long. And I'm going, please don't wake up. Please don't wake up, because the first thing she's going to see is me.
Yeah.
that was my first introduction to grizzly bears.
Very cool.
They did the, what happened is she got so excited or upset because the cub was in, and it was a little cub,
mm,
was in one trap and she was in the other.
Yeah.
She kept running in face first, snout first into the grid stuff at the end of the culvert trap,
mm-hmm,
and split her lip between her nose and her mouth, which is about that far. So what's that? Three inches.
Yep.
And the vet was stitching it up while I was holding her head. That's why I had to hold her head steady so that he could get that done. And he had self-dissolving stitches. And the cub was, after we got that done, one of the other guys and I were checking on the cub. And we noticed there was a piece of wire in there that had gotten in there somehow. And we said, nah, that shouldn't be in there. Could get injured, you know, step on it in the paw, whatever. So we crank up the gate just enough to grab it. And just as we get it out and start the gate down, that cub jumped up and came straight at us. And here's this little, 2 foot bear, but it still was enough for you to jump back like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
a lot of those experiences that stick with you. Because that was 1980, what was that, 1981?
Nice. Yeah, but you don't remember, you never forget holding a grizzly bear's head in your hands.
Yeah.
Never. Mm-mm. Never. No, banding eagles. You never forget banding eagles. Yeah. So, geez, Roy, thanks for sitting down and sharing with the listeners of Warden's Watch your experience as a U.S. Fish and Wildlife officer and as a U.S. Fish and Wildlife special agent, your tour around the country, Africa, your experiences with grizzlies, which is, in my mind is epic, I wish I could live another life and be a game warden in the West.
Yeah, it's definitely, that's one of the things with NAWEA that I'd love to see is the exchange program, where someone from New Jersey can go do an exchange and spend whatever length of time, week, whatever it is, with British Columbia to see something totally different.
100%.
That's a great program that NAWEA has.
The officer exchange. Get out of your comfort zone, see what the other side does, and vice versa. The British Columbia guy going to New Jersey, and my God, his head's going to spin too. So, which they got to have one of the highest populations of black bears and black bear problems, the most black bear problems in the country. So, population versus, black bears. It's just, that's where they meet. That's where most of our incursion problems happen in the people bear situations. So thanks for sharing so much, Roy. I just appreciate it. So
you're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Great.
Please join me, Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and other game wardens on our adventures protecting wildlife, saving lives, and having fun, all while serving the public and the natural resources of our planet. Listen to the tales and experiences of those who work in the outdoors while being entertained with stories about encounters with poachers, wildlife investigation, murder investigations, near-death experiences, search and rescue missions, wildlife interactions from game wardens around the country and around the world. When I retired, I realized I couldn't let go of that legacy, but rather wanted to share the passion, the commitment, and the stories of those men and women that call themselves game wardens. This is Game Warden Wayne Saunders, and this is Warden's Watch.